Thank you, Brother Burrell, for those remarks. This chapter is now open for comments. Nehemiah chapter 13. Brother Philip.
Looks like you just start the discussion and then the other brethren can add comments. I'd like to thank Brother Burrell for drawing our attention and drawing our conclusion to the chapter. I think it seems, you know, when you consider some of the things that Brother Burrell put it very well, you know, we've been considering the value of the family, and Brother Burrell has brought our attention to the perversion of the family with the marriage with the alien. But I thought that he perhaps provided us with, you know, the antidote for all these things when he said about studying, and I thought that was a good exhortation. You know, I'm going to try and take that exhortation home with me to remember that, you know, we can become jaded and we can become tired, but you know, we need to stimulate ourselves and study these things, as Paul said, to show ourselves approved unto God, workmen that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. So the closing remarks that Brother Burrell has given us is coupled kind of a warning, but also with the positives of encouraging us to study the scriptures daily. And in a sense, as Paul said elsewhere, so much the more as we see the day approaching. Just a kind of a thought that I might suggest, and again, this is a purely a suggestion. We know that when we're considering Ezra, I think it's pretty certain that Haggai and Zechariah were the prophets during that period, because in part of one of the chapters of Ezra, they specifically mention. So we know that Haggai and Zechariah stirred up the people with their prophetic messages to arise and build in the time of Ezra. It's been suggested that the prophet that equates with Nehemiah is Malachi, and this is just something that maybe we haven't thought about during the course of the week, but it might be something just for us to consider and perhaps go away with. For example, in the fifth chapter of Nehemiah, we refer to Nehemiah referring to the former governors. This expression, the governors, is an expression which is found in the book of Malachi, if you remember the time when Israel is being chastised for their blemished offerings. He says, try offering it to your governor and see if he'll accept it. In that same chapter, Nehemiah said, so did not I because of the fear of God. The fear of God was before his eyes. Not the fear of terror, but the fear of respect and reverence. And in Malachi chapter 3, verse 16, we note that they that feared Yahweh spoke often one to another, and the book of remembrance was written. In the chapter that Brother Burrell has drawn our attention to, he specifically referred to in verse 23, in those days I saw Jews that had married the wives of Ashdod, and Ammon, and of Moab. And Malachi talks in his second chapter, in verse 11, Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah hath profaned the holiness of Yahweh, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. Malachi seems to sort of like sharpen the point on this. He said they married the daughter of a strange god. Well, we know that the strange gods of the nations were mere idols, wood and stone or something, but he was basically saying to do that, you're like marrying their gods. And incidentally, the word God there is the word El in Hebrew. These were a power. Of course, we know they had no power, but they had power over the devotees. So the dangers are there quite clearly to be seen. The other pops remark is in verse 10 of the chapter, where he said, I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. And in Malachi 3, verses 8 to 10, we'll just verse 10, he says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouses, that there may be meat in mine house. So there seems to be a number of thought links with the prophecy of Malachi there. So something that we could think about when we are thinking about the book of Nehemiah.
Brother Justin?
I just had a question. If we know the time that lasts between the last chapter and this chapter, in regards to how long it took them to fall away, basically.
Brother Jim?
Nehemiah's king is Artaxerxes Longimanus, and he reigned only 40 years total. And actually, I say only 40 years. He was probably the longest reigning of the Persian monarchs in that he reigned 40 years. If, as we've been discussing here, the commands go forth in the 20th year of his rule, and Nehemiah continues in the kingdom to the 32nd year of his rule, then it has to be within 8 years if he's coming back under that king, and it seems likely he would. There's a great deal of turmoil after Artaxerxes' reign. The next king doesn't last very long. The one after him lasts even less. And then we finally get into Darius Nesotros, who then reigns 19 years, but is actually kind of hostile to the Jews. And the Jews rebel under Egypt during his reign. So anyway, the point is, it's probably a very short period of time here if these dates are right, that we're going from the 20th year of his reign, stays in the city to the 32nd year, and then is dead by his 40th year, that rebellion has to occur quite quickly. Which, of course, is a frightening warning to us of how quickly we can lose the truth if we're not careful with it.
Brother Matthew?
Start off with thanks to Brother Bill again, and a great talk and a fitting conclusion to the study of the book of Nehemiah, and linking in some of the ideas of the chronology and the book of Malachi. I can't comment much on chronology, I leave that to the expert, but certainly with the book of Malachi, I think that there does appear to be a connection, and we see the apathy and beginning of the apostasy amongst the people in Nehemiah here, especially towards the latter chapters, and there seems to be a connection with what we find in the book of Malachi. And it's been suggested that one of the chapters in Malachi was referring to the time in the interlude between Nehemiah's visit previous to chapter 13 and the current visit in chapter 13. And of course the main focus of the book of Malachi is on the coming of Christ, but there's a primary application quite possibly to the life of Nehemiah. And in the third chapter of Nehemiah it says, behold, I will send my messenger before my face, and he shall prepare the way before me. Which is referring in the fullest sense to John the Baptist. But it goes on to say, but who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and full of soap, and he shall sit and purify the sons of Levi, that they might offer a pure offering unto Yahweh. And this was what Nehemiah was doing. In this chapter, he was purifying the sons of Levi. The sons of Levi, which had been polluted by marrying, as Brother Phil brought out, the daughters and sons of a strange god. And the result, as Brother Bill brought out, was this mishmash, a hodgepodge, where they were speaking half the language of the Jews and half the language of these nations around. So there was a compromise which had taken place. Some of the exhortations for us, we know that there is going to be a day when the Lord shall come into his temple. And the question for us is, who shall stand when he appeareth? Brother Dan exhorted us this morning and said that we need to choose us this day whom we are going to serve. There's no parlying with sin. There's no in-betweenity when it comes to matters of living the truth and living the light of the world. We have to choose between the one or the other. The Israelites, who had this half and half scenario, were deemed as unacceptable when that inspection of the messenger of the covenant was conducted. You know, for ourselves, we have to question our own lives: to what extent is the world finding inroads into our thinking and into our actions?
Brother Freddy?
Like Brother Jim was mentioning, we've got to watch out that that doesn't happen to us. And we often look at Israel's history of up and down and backsliding, and backsliding Israel. How long through the history of Christadelphians, how long have they been able to go without some division or some other crotchet or something else coming up? So we see it in Israel, but we've got to look towards it in our own sphere and try to take root and keep what is the truth and its purity.
Brother Glendon?
It was mentioned a couple times earlier in the week that verse 25 plucked off their hair, and really got me curious as to what was going on there. Anyway, finally got over my initial misconception that it was smiting and plucking out the hair of the wives. It was actually the Jews that had married the wives that he's contending with. It was with them that the fault lay. Anyway, it says he contended with them. In other words, he admonished them according to the law, rebuked them, and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair. The original word is to make them bald, and made them swear by God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves." So this idea of plucking off the hair or making bald shows up a lot of times in scriptures, actually. And it's associated with cleansing, renewal, separation, and shame or mourning. One of them we just read was in 2 Samuel 10, verses 4 and 5, where David sends his servants to congratulate the king that had recovered of his sickness. And they suppose him to be spies, and they shave off half their beards and cut off their robes hard by their buttocks, it says, and sends them back home. It says they were greatly ashamed, and David actually allows for them to stay at Jericho until their beards be grown again. So you have the idea of shame there. Also, Deuteronomy 21:12, if there was a captive woman that was to be made someone's wife, they would have shaved their heads as a symbol of leaving behind the old and picking up the new. Several other passages there you could go through. Leviticus 13 talks about it, number 6. But you have this cutting off of the old and rebirth. And it's also associated with the vow, as it was here. Apostle Paul, it says, made a vow in Cenchrea, and he shaved his head as a token of that vow.
Brother Johnny?
Brothers and sisters, in reference to this marrying and intermingling with the nations around them, or what we would call marrying out of the truth, it's interesting that Nehemiah brings Solomon up to them as an example. We had just read where, when Solomon was born, a very interesting comment that it says, she bare a son, and David called his name Solomon, and Yahweh, or the Lord, loved him. Right when he was born, from his birth, he was beloved of God. He was the example to David that although the first child died, this child from Bathsheba didn't, and it was God's confirmation to him that terrible sin had been done away with. But Solomon didn't live up to his expectations. And to think about how God loved him as so much, or what we might think blessed him, he was blessed, he had greater riches, a greater throne, a greater system of government than the kings before him, helped by the preparation that David did in conquering the enemies and getting all the wealth. But Nehemiah brings this up to him. Did not King Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? But he mentions this again. Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of God, and God made him king over all Israel. But he failed with what he calls outlandish or illegal for him to marry women. And it's a great lesson that we have to be aware of, that we can be loved of God, but we can lose that favor by our actions. And no matter how much we love, God will not be mocked. When he gives us command, he expects us to obey it. It's interesting with Nehemiah continues, as to this, shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God in marrying strange wives? Now we might think, wait a minute, did they think for a minute Nehemiah is going to do that? Yet he seems to answer them that way. And what we see is, it is a cancer on the brotherhood. It's a pollution that the more it's done, the easier it is for others. And so, young people, you have a great obligation. If we're going to keep the truth and you're going to pass it on to your children, you're going to have to marry within the truth those that are dedicated to the truth.
Brother Burrell.
You know, our brother mentioned about the plucking off of the hair, and you think about that action. Nehemiah running around plucking off the hair. What would you think if all of a sudden I started running around here plucking hair off somebody and pulling the hair out? Well, you know, when Paul was talking to Festus, and Festus looked at Paul and said, "Thou art beside thyself. Much learning doth make thee mad." Well, here's Nehemiah with much learning, and he appears to be mad. But it's not a madness. It's a very important point that he brings out. Nehemiah was hot for the truth. You know, he was hot for God. It was an anger. He was striving for God. Those that are cold or lukewarm, or in the world, that appears to be madness. But it's not. It's love of God, and God is so diametrically opposed to man's thoughts and man's ideas that when man sees a righteous man, they think he's crazy. They think he's mad. And that's not the case at all. It's the fact that they don't understand God, they don't understand holiness. And once you understand God, understand holiness, the actions of Nehemiah, the actions of Paul, they're plain common sense. You understand the reasoning behind it. And it's not a madness as it appears on the surface.
Brother Dan?
I have more of a question than I have a comment, and it goes into the last two verses, or I guess the last three verses of the chapter here, which Burrell dealt with. It actually goes back even to 28, and one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, therefore I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. And my question is, where did they go? It seems like, in the nations, when they came into the land, they were supposed to destroy the people. They left, always showed up later. There was always something that came about from them. So they chased them away from them. If anybody's done any thought on this, is this the beginning of the Pharisees, the scribes? Just a thought.
Brother Jesse?
Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to Brother Dan's question, but I also happened to give a talk on this chapter in Canada recently, and so it was kind of fun to hear this talk as well, kind of relate. Something I'd been kind of confused on when I was writing mine, that I was, I guess, too shy to ever ask anyone about, was the meaning of Elisha's name. And I looked it up, and as pointed out, the name of it was El, will restore, or along those lines of restoring. And yet we saw that he gave Tobiah, an Ammonite of all people, you know, a place. And you know, he was a high priest and everything, so it seemed contradicting for him to have a good name and yet do something so incredibly wrong. And kind of what I tied it in with is, reminds me of Judas Iscariot being one of Christ's disciples, that it goes to show that just because you're, you know, baptized, just because you're in the truth, doesn't mean you're saved. Obviously, we're still human, you know, all the way through until Judgment Day. And so I found it, like I said, confusing at first, but it just shows no one's perfect. Anyone can fall away if they're not strong enough or if they let themselves. But I guess I found it kind of interesting.
Brother Jim? Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe. My mind's blank. Dave? Thank you first.
The 17th verse, Brother Burrow brought out about the Sabbath day and how they were kind of in their minds saying that they were keeping it by doing it just outside the gate, but still corrupting it and profaning it. And we flip back just a couple of chapters to the 10th chapter and the 31st verse. When the people had taken the oath, they said, if the people of the land bring wares or any victuals on the Sabbath day to sell, that we will not buy it of them on the Sabbath day. You know, so this is something that they started strong on, and then we see that they waned from it. And you know, I remember the older brothers talking about how Sundays used to be a day where all the stores were closed and everything, and in my lifetime they were opened at noontime and on. And you know, the brother was talking about it, and my car had broken down. I said, oh, I thought it was pretty great that they're open, because now I don't have to wait to Monday to get the part, and I can go to work, and I don't have to find transportation. It made my life a lot easier. But as the world eats away at God as a whole, and it has an effect on us, you know, even working in a school system, they had open houses now, or for a time were held on Sundays. And you think, well, if you work for a school, you never have to worry about working on a Sunday, and it's just you see the deterioration, and it's not all at once, because people would stand up against it, but it's slow in the world, and then it's slow in the truth, and we have to make sure that we stand up against it, otherwise we can be pulled away.
Brother Jim? Oh, sorry, Brother Ben?
Like to just add on to what Brother Glendon and I believe Brother Johnny had commented, starting in verse 25 there, where Nehemiah was contending with them, and he says he cursed them and smote certain of them. So he smote them and he ripped out their hair. Well, if you remember, part of the Nazarite vow was that a razor should never come upon one's head. And that was an outward sign of the commitment they had made of this oath with God. So after the reading of the law, and what Nehemiah was trying to reinstill in the people, their values and their oath to God as their father, that it obviously would have been a shame, but it would have been an outward sign of their disobedience and their straying from their father. And he carries on and makes them swear, almost corners them. It sounds like that, saying, "You shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves." And he compares them to the wisest man that aside from Christ, that the world has ever seen, Solomon, king of Israel. Did that not cause him to sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of his God. God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even as the wisest king has ever ruled, did these outlandish women of the world cause to sin. And Brother Burl, in his introductory remarks to this chapter, referred us to Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 20, which read this as follows: "My son, keep thy father's commandments, forsake not the law of thy mother, bind them continually upon thine heart, and tie them about thy neck." So here again, in these wise words of David's son Solomon, we can see the family unit, as is the theme of throughout this week's exhortations, that there is first the natural, through the biological parents, how it's of utmost importance that we heed their laws and their ordinances as we grow up as children. And also then follows the spiritual, whereas, "My son, keep thy father's commandments." This is our Father in heaven, of course. And we know that the ecclesia can often be considered as the mother. So if we, through humility and service, as our brother Dan exhorted us this morning, approach meetings and confrontations and issues in the ecclesia with an open mind, we will all be bettered and be able to unitedly walk in our master's service.
Brother Curtis?
If you look at how fast these went back to the ways they were doing before, it's really amazing, and people, and they brought out how fast it was. If you look at the history here, they returned probably about 90 years before this time into the land, and it took them a long time to get to this point. And Ezra came back, and then Nehemiah came back. Nehemiah has to return back to the king, and then when he comes, then he finds out all this is happening, and I believe that he returns in this chapter. But I think the biggest problem they had keeping, being able to stay, like, was this Elisha. Jesse was mentioned. Elisha, he don't seem like he tried to follow anything that he was told. He married, and he's a priest, and he marries Sanballat's daughter, and he lets Topiah be in the temple in one of the chambers. And you know, Nehemiah had spent quite a bit of time there and taught very hard, you know, how to keep the law. One other comment I noticed here about the wood offering. I don't think you may have mentioned anything about it. It's not really part of the law of Moses, and I'm thinking, why would they need a wood offering? And I guess it would be because under the Babylonians they had burnt everything in there, and there wasn't any wood. They had to bring up wood to be able to do the offerings.
Brother Burrow?
I know Brother Dan had asked about the start of the Pharisees. The only thing I can come up with is that in Matthew 24, verse 20, "But pray that you're not fight being winter nor on the Sabbath day," would be something to look at as the Sabbath day. They were following Nehemiah, they still would shut the gates, and the people wouldn't even get out. But that's the thing of thought that comes to mind.
Brother Glendon?
Brother Dan, Eliashib definitely holds the spirit of the Sadducees, one that doesn't mind compromising God's law for the benefit of Israel's acquaintances with the other nations, especially the nations that ruled over them. That was definitely the Sadducean spirit, and it was very much one of the priesthood. Eliashib here being the high priest certainly demonstrates strongly established seeds of Sadducees. And it was out of response to that that the Pharisees arose with very stringent requirements of the law and tried to hedge around it so that it would be protected from that decline that the Sadducees had shown. A quick comment again on what Brother Jesse had talked about, Eliashib's name, and how to him that was confusion. And I thought that was a good word there, confusion. You look through Genesis and you find Babel is synonymous with confusion, and later on Babylon, and we know that great Babylon is confusion. Also talks about in the law several very wicked things that God calls confusion. If a woman lies down to a beast, or if a man has his daughter-in-law to wife, or homosexuality, it calls them confusion. It's sickening to God. Confusion is sickening to God. You look at the original word, it means a mixture. And you know, worse than someone claiming that they are wrong and doing what is wrong, or claiming that they don't respect God and not respecting God, what's worse than that is when someone claims that they follow God and they mix that with human principles. They misrepresent God. God's looking for a correct manifestation of His principles, and they claim to manifest His ways, and yet they don't in action. In action, they misrepresent Him. It'd be like someone going around and saying, a worldly example. Say I'm going around and I'm selling cars. I'm a used car salesman. I say, yeah, you know Dan Jackson? I learned everything I know from Dan Jackson. And then I'm selling them all these ripoffs. That'd be worse than if I had never said anything about Dan Jackson. Just go and sell your ripoff vehicles. That's bad enough. But then you go and bring down somebody else's good names by doing that. It's even worse, right? And that's exactly what Eliashib did, exactly what Babylon had done, exactly what Christianity has done since Christ's day. They've mixed truth and error, and they've claimed that it's truth. And to bring it on home, we call ourselves Christadelphians. We call ourselves brethren of Christ. And we had better not even begin to mention God's name if we are not willing and committed to be a correct manifestation thereof. It's worse to never accept the truth at all, to never claim God at all, than to claim Him and then mix His truth, His manifestation, with that of error and evil.
Brother Johnny?
Brothers and sisters, in relation to these intermarriages, might make another quick comment in a different direction, where it says, in those days I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod and such, and their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language. Could not at all. And in relation to our relationships with one another and our friends and our marital partners, the end result will be, if we marry into the world, we'll have the same effect. And that'll be, they basically have the probability of speaking mostly in the speech of the world around us and not in the speech of a Christadelphian. It doesn't mean they can't speak English, but they can't speak in the Jews' language or that of a Christadelphian. We find when Peter was questioned down as a disciple of Christ, surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, thy speech agreeth thereto. And he began to curse and to swear. So we see that, yes, he had the accent, no doubt, of a Galilean, but he had the speech of a Christadelphian. And to try to hide that, he used the words of the world. And so young people today, again, you have an opportunity. You can learn to speak in the speech of a Christadelphian. And that doesn't mean using the names and titles of the deity when you do your Bible readings. It means the thought processes and the language and being able to speak to other people in the things of God, and not by using the examples and euphemisms and the cursings of the world. And if you're going to convince people the truth is right, you need to learn that language.
Brother Philip?
I'd just like to add some thoughts on top of what Brother Matthew brought to our attention a little earlier regarding the types and the exhortations that come. He coupled it with the prophecy of Malachi and the Lord whom he seeks shall suddenly come to his temple. This sudden appearance is something that we need to keep in mind ourselves. You wonder how sudden was Nehemiah's reappearance when he says, "I came to Jerusalem and understood the evil that Eliashib did for Tobiah." We thought of the parable that is recorded in Mark when Jesus said, "The Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to every man his work and commanded the porter to watch." In a sense, as Brother Matthew started that type in our minds, it's kind of like what Nehemiah did. He went, he said he wasn't at Jerusalem at that time. He departed into a far country. But he returned. "I came to Jerusalem." And it was a shock to him. It was almost like the unraveling of a lot of the work that he had done. And again, we think of the words of the Lord Jesus Christ as recorded in Luke 18 and verse 8. "When the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith in the earth?" You know, we're living in treacherous times, really. We've had various discussions, various exhortations during the course of the week. The pressure is on each and every one of us to hold fast, because we want to be found watching and waiting when our Lord suddenly appears. And of course, we know that in the New Testament, it says he comes as a thief. But of course, he doesn't come as a thief to the household of faith. He comes to the world as a thief who are totally not expecting him at all. They've given up all ideas of the Lord Jesus Christ returning. And they've given themselves over to the flesh pots of Egypt. So those flesh pots of Egypt are tempting to us. And we have to hold fast and keep our garments, lest we walk naked and our nakedness will be revealed in that day. So there's some powerful lessons to finish off our considerations, that when the antitypical Nehemiah appears, we pray that we all may have been watching, keeping our garments, making sure that we as servants have, as Brother Dan said this morning, kept our charge.
I believe that's about all the time we have. I thank the brethren for reading, and Brother Burrow for his opening remarks, and all the other brethren who commented.